Hey, everybody. I've got a little bit of housekeeping here before we get into the episode about Instagram and Theology Beer Camp. So I've been getting more active on Instagram, and I just want to let you guys know, in case you want to see me make some videos where I look directly into the camera, I'm sharing some stories and posts about basically all the topics that we cover on this show over at Instagram.com/DanKoke. That's C-O-K-E, and the link is in the show notes. Also, Theology Beer Camp is returning in 2024, October 17th through 19th. The theme is Return of the God Pods. That is a Lord of the Rings reference, which should surprise nobody. I will be there alongside Brian McLaren, Diana Butler-Bass, The New Evangelicals, Bible for Normal People, Tony and Josh from GGCH, of course, Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity, and a whole grip of others. And you can use the promo code RETURNOFYHP, all one word, for $25 off your ticket. Prices go up starting June 1st. That link will be in the notes. I hope to see a bunch of you guys there in October. It was a serious highlight of last year for me. Welcome, everybody, to You Have Permission, the show that aims to take both Christianity and the modern world of science and culture very seriously. My name's Dan Koch. I'm a licensed therapist and a post-evangelical liberal Protestant. And today I'm doing a solo mailbag episode, attempting to answer a number of questions relatively quickly. But of course, that is all indeed relative, and we'll see how I do. The first half of this episode will be on the main feed of You Have Permission, both podcast and YouTube. And the second half will be for patrons or permissionaries, as we call them, only. And you can go to patreon.com/DanKoke to join that community, where you receive at least two exclusive full episodes per month, as well as access to the patron-only Facebook group, which is a rad online community. Today's questions will cover books to read as you start faith deconstruction, podcasts I wish someone else would start, Oppenheimer versus Dune Part 2, whether Jesus' teachings in the Gospels are compatible with other religions being viable paths to God, albums that changed how I listen to music, what the Eucharist / Lord's Supper means to me today, and finally, this first question, which goes kind of straight for the gullet in, I think, a good way. Richard asks, your podcast intro states that you don't want to make liberal converts, but I've also heard you more recently say that you consider yourself an evangelist for a healthier / more progressive vision of Christianity. I'm paraphrasing, can't remember the exact words. How do you reconcile these ideals? Great question. First of all, I am in the process of shortening the intro to You Have Permission, but the intro that Richard is referring to has been on over 200 episodes of You Have Permission. So he's right to call attention to that. So maybe what I'm about to say is semantics to get myself off the hook in my own mind, but I don't think so. That'll be up for you to decide. I would distinguish here between my goal and my role, as in the role I think I'm supposed to play in sort of the media and larger landscape. I don't remember the specific context of my making that point about being an evangelist, so I don't remember if I was being a little tongue-in-cheek there or not, but I can say this. The goal of this podcast is not to get more people to like sign up for progressive Christianity, if that makes sense. My goals generally are to help people find language for what they've experienced, to model a kind of open curiosity and a careful way of thinking about complex issues, and to help people move beyond being stuck, that kind of thing. And the role that I think I'm probably supposed to play in this larger media ecosphere is that of a liberal Christian taking faith seriously while also taking this modern world of science and culture seriously. That means basically believing science as science in any particular question or arena kind of reaches a critical consensus, a very firm evidence base for something, then I think that my role is to model what it's like to take that at face value and make sure that my faith is not in contradiction to that, because I don't think that there are as strong of reasons for any particular faith answer, faith approach, theological position as there are for the most solid scientific claims. Now, with the new intro changing and all that, and there being a lot less content in there, if there is some potential hypocrisy, hopefully it's going to be lower going forward. But I really liked how pointed and direct that question was, Richard, so I thank you for it. All right, next question. Natalie asks, what are three books someone should read at the start of their deconstruction from evangelicalism? I like that nice little use of the Ezra Klein Show final question, Natalie. If you know, you know. No free ads, but I am pulling up my own website here that I co-created with Sari Martin Concepcion. That is soyourdeconstructing.com. Just letting you know, that is a resource. It doesn't have this list of like three books to read at the beginning, but it's got a lot of lists of articles, podcast episodes, books, and blogs sorted by topic related to faith deconstruction. So this is an easy way to mention that organically and let people know that that's there if they think that it would be helpful. The first one that came to mind, the first book that came to mind is Christian Smith's The Bible Made Impossible. Smith is a sociologist of religion. I would argue probably one of the top two or three sociologists of religion living today. That seems to be the consensus within the academic community. I find his work super compelling, very careful, thorough, well communicated, well explained. Yeah, just fantastic stuff. But this book, Bible Made Impossible, he does less sociology and he goes in to answer a question that he gets a lot, having himself converted to Roman Catholicism. And he's talking about this view of the Bible that is very common in what he calls biblicist circles. Biblicism is, I can't remember his definition of it, but it really well captures the way that I was taught to read the Bible growing up as a moderate evangelical. And he basically says, here's something that's been sticking in my craw since my advisor put forth this argument back in the 70s. And the argument is basically this: what biblicists and people who essentially inerrantists, people who believe that the Bible has been ensured by God that it does not contain serious errors, and crucially, that the Bible fits together, that if you correctly understand the Bible, then you will get a unified picture of the nature of God, our role in life, what we're supposed to do, the nature of salvation, the nature of Jesus, you know, the Trinity, all this stuff. You will get a unified picture. In other words, the Bible, which is all these different puzzle pieces, if you arrange those pieces correctly, it makes a puzzle, an actual finished puzzle with a clear picture. This is the view of a biblicist. And Smith says, here's the problem. There are 10,000 puzzles that people have made with this. So maybe the problem is not all the individual puzzle makers who can't seem to agree, or maybe their sinfulness keeps each of them from seeing some part or other, you know, all kinds of various explanations that somebody might give for why the picture isn't the same as another person's picture. And Smith just argues, maybe it's the Bible. Maybe the Bible itself doesn't lend itself to a complete puzzle picture, that actually the Bible does not agree with itself on every point. In other words, the Bible is multivocal. And I love this argument. Ever since I read it, I was like, yep, that fits the evidence way better for me. The reason that people can't agree, especially Protestants who have a lot more freedom in their interpretation of the Bible than the more liturgical and sort of hierarchical traditions like Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, stuff like that. Protestants can't agree, not because we can't agree as people. I mean, that's also part of it, of course. People are varied and they have different intuitions. But we can't agree on a standard picture of the Bible because the Bible doesn't lend itself to that. It doesn't work that way. And I'm convinced. So I would really recommend that book early on, especially if the Bible and understanding the Bible is a major source of confusion or tension or a growth area for you. Second, Bonnie Christian's book, A Flexible Faith. This is a super accessible read. She basically goes through, I don't know, 10 or so of the most contentious questions within Christianity. And she lays out the most standard, most popular variety of answers to those questions. So, is the Bible inerrant? She talks about inerrancy, infallibility, and mere inspiration, and various ways people have taken that to mean. What does the Bible say about women in ministry? She gives the different options of complementarian, egalitarianism, maybe something in between. She talks about, I believe, the end times. I don't remember if there's like a queer sexuality chapter or not. Different atonement theories. How do Christians understand the atonement to work? I've had Bonnie on multiple times to talk through individual chapters of A Flexible Faith. I will put links to those episodes in the show notes so you can kind of hear her and I bat a couple of those around. I believe the ones we did were atonement theories as well as views of inspiration of the Bible. But there's a bunch more in that book. So that is just a really great kind of early lay out the field as you're starting deconstruction. And third, since you specifically asked, Natalie, about the beginning of a deconstruction process and not later stages where many people might be looking for more of a reconstruction or a positive rebuilding of things, I would say early on, it's really worth considering the role of sexuality and purity culture in your individual upbringing. And I would say that for both men and women. Obviously, within purity culture, women take a lot more of the weight of the evil, I would say, and slightly softer, the sort of misguidedness of a purity culture informed approach to sexuality, but it also harms men as well, and in all kinds of ways. And I would say my favorite way into that I've read is Linda K. Klein's book, Pure, which involves both her telling her own story, but also she interviewed like 30 other women from her hometown and home church community and kind of compiled those interviews into themes. And so many people have told me how much they've loved that book and that some of those stories, they really found themselves in those stories. And I think that's a great place to start. I will give a shout out to The Great Sex Rescue by Sheila Gregoire and her co-authors, who I have had on the podcast as well to talk about that book. That's a bit more researchy, a bit more academic, but still very, very accessible. I think they did a 20,000 person interview with essentially conservative Christian women about all aspects of their sex life. And that's really research informed and really solid work. So I'll put a link also to that You Have Permission episode where I talked with her daughter and their kind of stats person who does most of their research. Now, if someone else has a question for a future episode, something like what three books would someone read who's attempting to re-engage their faith after a thorough deconstruction, I'll just put in a little ad. That would be a great question. That would be a fun one to answer later. Okay, next up, Edward asks, are Jesus's teachings and claims in the Bible incompatible with the possibility of Buddha and other major religious leaders also being inspired by God and offering another path to God? So some of the teachings that the gospel writers ascribe to Jesus are compatible with a pluralistic approach to Christianity, and some are not. And then there's almost like a middle category. And again, back to that Christian Smith thing about the Bible, it doesn't fit into a neat puzzle. So there are some passages where this is going to feel more realistic, and there are others where it's not. So Christian pluralism is a phrase I'd like to, or a term I'd like to briefly define. I just mean here that Christianity is in some sense true, but not in an exclusive way that entails that other religions are necessarily false in that they are distinct from Christianity. So this is a kind of both and option that Christians have for thinking about other faiths. In fact, some passages in the Gospels seem to me to be more than merely compatible, but actually argue for a more inclusive vision of the kingdom of God. For instance, there is the story where Jesus is asked about salvation, and he says, the Law and the Prophets, what does it say to you? And the person says, love God with your whole heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, you've answered correctly. Do this and you shall be saved. Obviously, someone in another faith tradition, at this point not Jewish, and at our point not Christian, could love God with their whole heart and love their neighbor as themselves, or at least do their best to do that. Then there are teachings that are certainly compatible with pluralism, where nothing about these teachings being true necessarily implies any tension with other religions also being inspired by God or true in their own way. So the majority of the Sermon on the Mount probably falls into this category. Blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are those who mourn, love your enemies, don't worry what you will wear or eat, consider the lilies and sparrows. If you're at a religious event and you realize that you have something unresolved with your brother, go resolve that. Even the stuff about blessed are you when people persecute you and revile you in my name, we might think that anybody being persecuted for their genuine faith in God has some special status in God's eyes, even if that thing that they're being persecuted for is not Christianity or at the time of Jesus, Judaism. But I do think also that some words of Jesus as presented in the Gospels are incompatible with pluralism. For instance, Mark 16:16, whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. This passage is often used to argue that belief in Jesus is essential for salvation. We've got John 3:16-18, whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. And these verses are seen as underscoring the necessity of belief in Jesus for salvation. One more, Matthew 10:32-33. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I also will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. Now, I think that the earlier question that I answered about the Bible made impossible by Christian Smith, about the Bible being multivocal, this is important here. There are passages in the Gospels that present an exclusive Christianity, and there are passages that don't. Now, I used to think I had to put those passages together and make them fit together somehow. So maybe, for instance, here's how I would have done it. Okay, so yeah. Anybody in any religion could love God with their whole heart and love their neighbor as themselves, but the wages of sin is death, so they can't do it. So Jesus is saying, well, theoretically you could, but no one can because no one is good but the Father, or maybe the Father and the Son. And so you have to have the propitiation of Jesus's blood on your sin so that you can be saved. And someone else trying to love God and their neighbor, they might do pretty well, but they're never going to get there, and so they can't be saved without the blood of Jesus. So that would be a way to try and put those passages together. Nowadays, I just say, here's a passage that's inclusive, and here's a passage that's exclusive. And it is actually up to me as an individual to figure out where I stand between those passages, because the Bible isn't going to do it for me, because the Bible does not agree with itself. Now, that feels weighty for a lot of people, but it's a pretty elegant solution, and I think it is the one that best matches the biblical evidence itself. So we have to discern and choose among these voices when they contradict each other.
You must choose, brothers, you must choose.
And by the way, I would just like to close this question by saying that every Christian, even conservatives, do engage in this choosing of some biblical voices over others. Generally, their choice of denomination does a lot of that choosing for them, or their pastor, and kind of what he or she thinks is the sort of most important stuff in the Bible. You'll notice that if you go to an evangelical megachurch, if they preach on it is harder for a rich man to enter heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of the needle, you will find that in, I would guess, 99 out of 100 of those churches, they will not take that passage literally. They will not say, okay, we have to give away our money. They won't. They will interpret it in light of other passages that kind of gets them off the hook. And by the way, I don't live as if that passage is literally true either. I'm not giving all my money away so that I can enter heaven more easily than a camel might get through the eye of a needle. I have made decisions that, you know what? Even if that passage should be taken literally, I'm not doing that. I have discerned that I will not do that. I will actually use my income to have a fairly comfortable and survival pressure-free existence for my family. So I've already done that discerning work, and I've come to a conclusion about a passage like that. The rest of these questions are going to be answered on the other side of the Patreon. People talk about a wall, but maybe it's better to talk about a curtain that is torn. Is that blasphemous? Anyway, so if you want to hear the rest of this, either audio or video, head over to patreon.com/DanCoke. Thanks, guys.